Kildare Focus with Kira Noble.
A very happy Thursday afternoon to you. Thank you for joining me here on Kildare Focus. Coming up in the next few moments, we'll be speaking with the Irish Heart Foundation about CPR. Brian Killoran, the Chief Executive of the Immigrant Council of Ireland, will join us a little later on the new report that says survivors of human trafficking have minimal supports in this country. Fintan Horahan is the Chief Executive of the Irish Dental Association, and over 13,000 children are waiting for urgent orthodontic treatment. We have heard a lot about the Dental Association and dental health throughout this country over the past year or so in regards to the medical card in particular. So if you have any questions that you want me to put forward to the Chief Executive of the Irish Dental Association, do get in touch on our Whitewater Shopping Centre text line. That is 0833 97 97 97. Obviously Christmas can be an incredibly difficult time for so many people who are bereaved, and the founder and the Chief Executive of Onam Cara will join us. It's about the support meeting that is happening for bereaved parents in County Kildare and obviously the surrounding counties in the lead up to Christmas. Some advice there. Sharon Vard will join us. And finally, Shane Heinen, photographer, will join us on the free exhibition of the bog landscape in the Midlands and the people connected to them. That's taking place in the Riverbank Theatre in Newbridge. Again, get in touch with us this afternoon. I just gave out the text line, and of course the phone line is 045 901 490 and the email is studio@kfmradio.com. Now, Irish people are among the most willing in the whole world to try CPR when they witness someone having a heart attack, when bystanders taking action in 84% of cases. Joining me is Resuscitation Manager with the Irish Heart Foundation, Bridget Sinnott. Good afternoon, Bridget. And Bridget, are you there now? I believe you should be able to hear me, and we can hear you, hopefully.
I can hear you.
Perfect. Bridget, do tell us a little bit more about this 84%, huge amount.
It is indeed, and I mean, it's something that the nation should be very proud of, that people are so willing to assist in the event of a cardiac arrest. So when somebody suffers a cardiac arrest, it's this immediate recognition that someone is unresponsive and not breathing properly, and you're in the ambulance service on 999 or 112. And then the call taker, they start to ask some questions. And we're very lucky here in Ireland that we have this dispatch-assisted CPR. So these call takers are highly trained, and they help you recognise if the person is having a cardiac arrest or not. And I suppose that definitely adds to, you know, people getting in then and starting CPR because they have that assistance on the phone from the call taker.
As a country, Bridget, would Ireland be one of those with many defibrillators? Because when you do travel around the country, and obviously here in County Kildare and surrounding areas, there are so many defibrillators. A lot of communities have come together to raise money to ensure that there are defibrillators in a community. And I've heard stories of so many people, their lives actually being saved because of these defibrillators.
Yeah, so the thing with a cardiac arrest is cardiac arrests happen so suddenly, and over 70% actually happen in the home because, you know, people think that they happen out on the street or on the pitch or wherever. But the majority of cardiac arrests happen in the home. So we're always saying people should really get in and learn how to do CPR because it's probably a family member you'll have to do it on. Again, roughly, the statistics around the world would tell us that roughly 75% actually, who have a sudden collapse are in a shockable rhythm. And that's when you need your defibrillator. So not everybody in a cardiac arrest is going to be in a shockable rhythm, but as I said, roughly 75% who initially collapse. Now, another statistic that there is that for every minute without CPR or defibrillation, your chances of survival decrease by 10% per minute. If somebody starts doing compressions, you double their chances of survival. If you can get your AED on the chest, you drastically improve their chances of surviving. Because if you're in one of these shockable rhythms, the only treatment then is to get that shock, you know, get the AED on the chest and get that shock in. And it really, really does make a difference.
Now, approximately half of these cardiac arrests, they're witnessed by bystanders and standers. And one of the things I think most people think about when potentially they could ever be in a situation like that is, will they go into shock? What advice do you have for people to, I guess, get themselves out of that fight or flight stage if they do witness somebody, obviously, in cardiac arrest?
Yeah, So, and that's going back again to this dispatch assisted CPR. If you ring the ambulance service, like, don't hesitate, ring 112 or 999, either number, right? And the thing is that the quicker you do that, the quicker then the call taker will be able to establish with you if the person needs CPR. If someone is only after fainting, but you think they are in a cardiac arrest, isn't it better to be after checking than be sorry afterwards? So
in that case, Bridget, would say if you do mistake somebody for you originally think would say they just fainted or something, are there any key things to note in the differences between someone having an actual cardiac arrest and someone would say fainting or becoming unwell in some other circumstance?
Yeah, so both of them are obviously going to be unresponsive, right? But when you just scan for breathing, if someone is breathing normally like you are, they're fine. They're probably just after fainting. If someone has maybe some erratic breathing or not breathing at all, that person is more than likely in a cardiac arrest. And that's when you start doing your compressions. And one of the things that I would say is don't ever be afraid to start compressions. You can do no harm. It's better to do CPR on someone who doesn't need CPR than not do CPR on someone who does. So
now,
you're
Bridget,
not going to cause any harm.
A lot of people listening will hear about CPR and they themselves may think, God, I have no idea how to do this. How can they get in touch with, I guess, some sort of class or something? Will the Irish Heart Foundation be able to get people in touch with those who are delivering classes, you know, whether that's online or throughout the country?
Okay, so what we've done is, at the minute, because of COVID and that, community classes are a little bit less than they used to be. So we've put some videos up on our website on irishheart.ie. If you click on to CPR and then you'll see hard and fast rule. And underneath that, there are three videos. One is making the emergency call. It goes through exactly what you're going to be asked by the call taker. The second one is how to perform CPR. And the third one is using an AED. Also on the website then, we have a list of people who provide classes. We're not able to put up the classes for each day, but we have a list of people who provide classes, and then people can make contact with people in their area, see the availability of classes. So again, if you go on to the section that says CPR for public, there's little drop-down menus and you have a list of numbers of that people can contact. Now, as I said, Darren, it is a little bit harder at the minute to get classes because of the COVID situation.
Yeah.
Again, in your area as well, you may be lucky and very fortunate to have a community first responder group. And the community first responder groups are very good about running public classes and keeping people up to date. So again, check in your area and see, is there a group? Maybe you'd like to get involved, or maybe you'd like to attend some of their training. And it is worth, you know, contacting some of them.
Absolutely, yeah.
See what's available.
I'm actually just on the irishheart.ie website right now, as Bridget was mentioning there. And one of the main headlines on the main page or on the homepage of that website is CPR. So when you do hover over it, it drops down, as Bridget was saying, and it has different sections. CPR for instructors, CPR for the general public, CPR courses for healthcare professionals, CPR for schools, which is something I think definitely should be taught in schools, and then the hard and fast rules. So there's always so much information out there, and I guess we got to take advantage of that, because you never know what situation you may be, and you may actually be the person who needs the help. So you'd obviously be greatly appreciative of anybody who takes their time to learn CPR, which really I think probably we all should be learning when we're in school, Bridget. But that's a conversation for another day, I guess.
Well, we can talk about that too.
Listen, Bridget Sinnott, Resuscitation Manager with the Irish Heart Foundation, thank you very much for joining me this afternoon. And Brendan has been in touch on 0833 97 97 97. And Brendan, I remember you saying this before, and he said, great to see KFM publishing CPR again, something that means a lot to him because Brendan is a cardiac arrest survivor. And it's amazing when you hear from people. I don't know if you guys remember during the summer, Christian Eriksen, he had cardiac arrest on the pitch during the Euro 2020s. And we spoke about it then also. So, and I know you were in touch then too, Brendan. So it's amazing. And obviously people like Brendan out there just highlighting how important and literally life-saving it is to learn CPR. So something I think we can all get behind. And thank you, of course, to Bridget.
Kildare Focus with Kira Noble.
Now, there's a new report out from the Immigrant Council of Ireland. So it's funded by the EU. It's the culmination of TRIPS, which is Trafficked International Protection Beneficiary Special Needs. It's a project and it examined the integration conditions and risk for victims being exposed or re-exposed to human trafficking across Europe. And it notes the sexual exploitation of vulnerable migrant women continued unabated during the pandemic. Joining me to discuss this is the Chief Executive of the Immigrant Council of Ireland, Brian Killoran, and thank you for joining me, Brian.
Thank you, Ciara.
Brian, it really is upsetting to read that top line because the huge majority of those who are migrants are trying to find a better life, and to think that those people have gone through what they've gone through, you know, fleeing the countries that they're fleeing, and then end up being sexually exploited in the place where they feel they might find safety.
It is, and I suppose it's worth reflecting on the fact that, you know, internationally, like, migration obviously is a hot topic, but the very human story behind it is often, you know, simple stories of hope in terms of people wanting to move to another country to have a better opportunity, you know, going through the channels that are normal in terms of work permits and green cards and different things like that. But then when it comes down to the limited options people have for illegal migration, sometimes those areas are ripe for exploitation from the likes of traffickers and people smugglers. In particular reference to what we're launching today, it's centred around our work in support of victims of human trafficking. So trafficking on a global level is a massive, massive issue. Essentially around 25 million people every year are subject to trafficking, whether or not initially first trafficked or still in a situation.
That's globally, is it?
That's globally, 25 million. And of those, approximately 70% are women and girls, because sexual exploitation is by far the biggest area within human trafficking at a global level. And it's even reflected in Ireland as well in terms of the numbers here. So that's global, but, and we see it in Ireland too, obviously, that it's a smaller issue in Ireland, and obviously it's not to that extent. But at the same time, in 2020, there were 38 victims of human trafficking identified in Ireland. And everyone, including the authorities, you know, recognises that that's absolutely the tip of the iceberg in terms of the true number that's probably out there. But of those 38 victims identified last year, 33 were women, and the majority, again, were in sexual exploitation situations. So it's, trafficking is essentially coercion and deception. It's telling somebody, if you enter into the situation, we'll get you a student visa or whatever it may be to come to a country. You can work, you can improve your English, it'd be a great opportunity for you. The person goes into it thinking that it's a normal circumstance, but when they get to Ireland, then they find out it's much different. And it's usually done by imposing a debt. So you now owe us €5,000 or €10,000 or €15,000, and you'll have to work in this extra aid to pay that back.
So Brian, am I to kind of assume from this that sometimes some of these women and men, I know it's the vast majority are women, may come to this country and may decide to work in the sex industry or as a sex worker? We know technically it is illegal, but they may decide to do that. And they're exploited within the industry when they know they'll be entering into it, leaving the country that they're leaving, or it's completely by fluke or by unfortunate coincidence that they end up in this situation?
Well, it varies. A lot of the women that we work with through our legal service, so we're an independent law centre as well, most of them coming through our legal service thought they were coming to Ireland on completely different grounds. They thought they were coming to Ireland to study. They thought they were coming to Ireland to work. They'd been promised a job. They had no interest or desire of going anywhere near the sex industry. But as I say, when they came to Ireland, then the people that organised it told them, OK, you owe us money now. And to do this, you'll have to go into the sex trade. And it often isn't just the suggestion of doing it. It's forced into the sex trade. It's like actual loss of liberty and being locked in an apartment in some of the cases that we've seen. So it is extreme. There are instances as well where women will come to Ireland and, you know, decide themselves. There's no traffickers involved, but they decide themselves to be involved in the sex trade. And that, you know, there instances also that need support, and that people most often come to services, not necessarily ours, but the likes of Rahama and others, after a couple of years of doing that and going, okay, I need to get out of this. How do I do it now? And how do I get an exit strategy, essentially? How do I, you know, leave the situation that I'm in? But as I say, most of the time, trafficking involves deception. To qualify as trafficking, it involves deception. So women have no idea whatsoever that they're going to be forced into the sex trade at the other end of the journey.
So these victims have already fled the countries they're fleeing. They're already in emotional distress, leaving those countries, whether they wanted to or not, knowing that it'd be a better life, well, or hoping that they would have a better life. But then they find difficulty isolating or maintaining social distance within the cramped living conditions of direct provision centres, which we know is a major issue in this country. So not only are we speaking about the sexual exploitation of these people, but also other health risks they have, because we're still in the middle of a pandemic.
Yeah, that's been particularly highlighted over the last couple of years, especially 2020 and 2021, obviously. Like, the accommodation of victims of trafficking, whether or not they've applied for international protection or refugee status, or if they're coming through different routes. Not everybody applies for a refugee status. But basically, as soon as anybody comes to the attention of the authorities or gets discovered as having been a victim of trafficking, they're put in direct provision. So as everybody's well aware, direct provision has been criticised by everybody pretty much for the last number of years and is down for abolition in the current plan for government. But in the last 2 years, the situation of people in direct provision has been dire. You know, they've been under lockdown conditions, living in rooms with strangers, essentially. Sometimes a whole family confined to a room when people couldn't go out or couldn't work or the kids couldn't go to school. And for victims of trafficking then as well. So they're coming from situations usually where they're trying to come back from high levels of trauma, absolutely, you know, phenomenal levels of things like PTSD and depression and anxiety, having gone through situations of sexual violence, but be in a shared room then with three other people during a pandemic when they couldn't leave. And, you know, even having a conversation then, for example, with their lawyer, you know, lawyers were trying to make do during that time by doing things like WhatsApp FaceTimes and, you know, using Zoom and all these kind of things. But even doing that then in a room with three other people is very, very bad conditions for getting legal advice and getting legal support. So it's been doubly impactful for people in direct provision, and then more so again for very vulnerable categories within direct provision, like victims of trafficking.
The research is also highlighting again just how difficult it can be for those victims to, you know, have or get access to support and integration pathways here in this country. What can we do in terms of better integration for those who unfortunately are victims of sexual exploitation?
Yeah, it's you know, I suppose when we were launching this today, we're keen to say that it's clear from the government's perspective that they know they need to reform this area. There's been a lot of work in the last 2 years to begin that reformation process, you know, but it hasn't borne much fruit yet, but it is getting better in terms of at least the increased onus they're putting on it. So a lot of that is around, so accommodation is one of them. They're hoping to address accommodation by launching a pilot next year of a kind of a different model of accommodating victims of trafficking away from direct provision. They're hoping to reform the identification process. You know, they've nominated the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission to be a national monitoring body on trafficking in Ireland. So it's going in the right direction, but it's very, very slowly. It's grindingly slowly. And what we're highlighting today is that we still have no systems in Ireland to, as you say, integrate a victim of trafficking. And what that breaks down to is essentially how to access employment, how to access education, how to access mental health services, get legal advice. You know, their very initial bare basic needs are taken care of. But everything after that then is pretty much they're left to themselves. And civil society try and fill the gap, like organisations like ourselves try and do as much as we can. There's a limited amount of state services available to them, but there's no long-term care plan. And for a victim of trafficking, in our experience, the recovery period is anywhere from 2 years to 5 or 6 years, you know, just from the experience that they've gone through. So it's a long road, and it's not a huge amount of people. You know, we're not talking thousands and thousands of people here necessarily, although the number is not known for sure. But it's a small number of people, but coming from an extremely, extremely difficult circumstance, that we do need to improve how we support them as a country, and give them a better chance of getting back their dignity and their self-sufficiency.
Brian, some people may say this question might be unfair, but in terms of, you know, you're mentioning the government, that things need to be done there. And I don't think anybody would argue with that, or many people wouldn't. But when it comes to the general public, do you think more responsibility needs to be on the shoulders of those living in Irish society? I guess understanding situations like this more and better, I guess you could say.
I think what the Irish public can do, they can do a couple of different things. You know, one thing is keeping the political pressure on local representatives. So, you know, in Ireland, politics is very, very local. And migration and diversity issues don't really factor into what most politicians think about as being the bread and butter of their work. Excuse me. It's pretty far down the list of priorities. But, you know, every community in Ireland is diverse. So, that's a reality of the change that Ireland has undergone in the last 20 years. So I think any opportunity to let a local politician know, oh, by the way, we know there's a direct provision centre down the road. We think that that needs to be, you know, the programme for government that promised that to be abolished needs to be followed through. So making sure that they're hearing it at a local level, because if they're not hearing it at a local level, they won't raise it in the Dáil, you know. So that's one thing. When it comes to things like trafficking, you know, what we even find that some of the migrant women that we encounter don't know that they've been trafficked themselves. They just know that a certain number of things happen to them.
But that's, they don't mad, isn't it?
They don't understand the concept of trafficking, this international definition of what constitutes trafficking. So sometimes it's a journey for them to go on to realise, actually, Jesus, like, that was exploitation. Yeah, that was all completely wrong, what happened to me. So that the general public wouldn't understand that as well, I don't knock them at all for.
Yeah.
But take the opportunities to listen to it. But most, you know, what most people can do is reach out to local people in your community, regardless of whether or not they're trafficking victims or whatever it may be. You won't know that anyway. But offer a welcome to people around you and help the integration process on your street or in your town or in your village, because that's ultimately how these things then will get addressed. Because if somebody who's isolated knows they can talk to somebody else, then they can come forward and try and get some help.
Yeah, and you know, you have to think about the shoe being on the other foot, and unfortunately for a lot of people, that's the only way for them to actually sit back and think about situations like this. And we know as Irish people, we went to many countries looking for help over the years, and we are a very generous nation, but things like that I think do need to be highlighted a little more. Look, the Chief Executive of the Immigrant Council of Ireland, Brian Killoran, thank you so much. And if anybody wants to get some more information on that, that full report is available on the Immigrant Council of Ireland's website this afternoon. Now, moving from that heavy topic to something a bit different. This is in regards to dental work. And the Chief Executive of the Irish Dental Association is on the line. He is going to discuss with us the over 13,000 children that are waiting for urgent orthodontic treatment. Fintan Horahan, good afternoon to you and thanks for the time.
Hello, Ciara.
Fintan, huge number of children waiting orthodontic treatment. And it's not just orthodontic treatment, it's urgent treatment.
Yes. So there was a parliamentary question which reveals the true nature of the wait list. These are children who have been assessed, who have been decided have severe orthodontic problems. So we're talking about children who have buried canines, overbites, or severe overcrowding. These would be the most severe instances and would require special orthodontic treatment. And many of them within that 13,000 will be waiting between 2 and 4 years currently for orthodontic care, which is completely unacceptable.
Now, Fintan, you've been on quite a bit over the past 12 months in particular to do with dentists, not orthodontists, dentists and the medical cards, etc. When it is the case of urgent orthodontic treatment, would that treatment always fall under, for children, the medical card holders, or would it depend on a case-to-case basis?
Well, it's not limited to medical. So when we talk about the medical card scheme, by and large, we're talking about care for over 16s, for adults, and that's separate again from orthodontic treatment. So the public dental service offers orthodontic treatments for children up to the age of 16 or the commence up to the age of 16, and that's what we're talking about in this instance. But you're right, I mean, there are instances of cutbacks in dental care for children and for adults. The medical card scheme is collapsing rapidly, which means that adults who need care are having greater difficulty accessing it. And what these figures show is that children also are having difficulty accessing badly needed dental treatment. And I suppose it just shows that dentistry has a very low priority amongst politicians.
It seems to be the case. When it comes to the orthodontists of this country, are they just not accepting those who are going to need their treatment, their orthodontic treatment, for free? Why is it that there's such a backlog? Explain that a little more for us.
Yeah, so I suppose there are orthodontists who work in private practice, but for the HSE system, we're talking about orthodontists that work in the public service for the HSE. It's not that they're not accepting.
Is there just not enough of them, Fintan?
Exactly. Yeah, there simply are not enough specialist orthodontists to cope with the demand. And just to explain, there is what they call an index of treatment need. So it is a scale of 1 to 5, 5 being the very severe cases requiring specialist treatment. And that's the bulk of what we're talking about here. I would say as well, not to paint too gloom a picture, but these are the children who have been assessed and examined. We know that there were 100,000 fewer examinations of children in first, second and fourth or sixth class, in three classes at primary level in 2020 as compared to 2019. Obviously, that was largely accounted for by the pandemic, but there are huge numbers of children who simply are not being seen or not being assessed and they require orthodontic treatment and aren't featuring on these waiting lists. So the problem is actually of a far greater magnitude than these figures would suggest.
And Fintan, I feel by and large for other health issues, people can understand just how badly delays can affect people's health and their healthcare going into the future. But when it comes to, I guess, dentistry and dental work in general, people mightn't be as au fait with the effects. So just kind of, you know, spell it out for us there, the effects on these children, more than 13,000, that are awaiting these urgent orthodontic treatments. What potentially could this mean, the huge delays?
Well, I mean, in the most extreme circumstances, it might require significant surgery, jaw surgery. That's only a small number of
And Fintan, am I right saying that in a lot of those cases, that would actually mean that someone's jaw would need to be broken? And I've heard that, you know, to literally get a jaw broken, you're repairing it and may have your jaw wired shut for literally 6 months.
Yes, it can involve that. I mean, I don't want to be too alarmist.
I know, I might be going to the extreme there. Yes, yeah.
Yes. But, I mean, either way, regardless, when somebody has a dental problem, whether it's gum disease or whether it's a tooth that ought to be filled, if the patient, be it a child or adult, isn't seen, very often what that means is that teeth will be lost, they won't be saved. And in the case of orthodontic care and treatment, it makes remedying the problem far more difficult. And of course, that's going to be very stigmatizing for many people. It's going to make them more self-conscious about their appearance. And in some cases, it might have some impact on everyday function and eating and their diet. So, you know, I don't want to be casting too gloomy a picture for people, because I think we have to be responsible at all times. But there's no doubt but that there's a consequence when problems aren't prevented, or where there's a delay when a problem manifests itself. Then ultimately, both in terms of the cost to health, but the financial cost also, there is a significant extra cost delaying treating a problem. And that's what we're talking about here.
Brian, realistically, how long would people be waiting to see the government step in and sort this situation out?
Well, you know, the HSE confirmed to us just in the last few days that they had sought funding for additional staffing in the dental service and the orthodontic services, and that wasn't provided. I know they are looking to provide a certain amount of referrals to private orthodontists. That's making a limited difference. It has taken them 6 months. We are finally going to meet them on Friday week to discuss the crisis in the medical care scheme. So everything seems to happen extremely slowly. And again, I come back to the point, dentistry and oral health seems to be very low on the list of priorities for the government. And I think for an awful lot of people, it's an essential part of good general health. And we would say that I think TDs locally in Kildare and West Wicklow need to wake up to the problems, because I checked the figures for Kildare and West Wicklow, and I looked at the number of children who were seen for screening at primary school level, and whereas in 2019 there was over 11,000, there was less than 4,000 in 2020. There was a 2/3 drop in
Okay, we seem to be losing Fintan's line there, but hopefully we will speak to him just before Christmas about those meetings that the Irish Dental Association will be having in regards to those waiting lists. Fintan Horahan there, the Chief Executive of the Irish Dental Yesterday afternoon at around this time, we were speaking about two art exhibitions that are taking place in, it was a NAIS art group and a Newbridge art group. Both were taking place online, and the Newbridge art group had an in-person exhibition running, which is still running until the 15th of December in the Charlotte Mall in Newbridge. But on the line this afternoon, we're going to be speaking with local photographer Shane Heinen about the free exhibition of the bog landscape in the Midlands and the people connected to it. It's taking place in the Riverbank Theatre in Newbridge. Hi, Shane.
Hi, Kira. How are you doing?
Good, good. We love talking about this kind of stuff on KFM, so thank you very much for joining us. So the work that is going to be on display in the Riverbank is exploring the bog landscape of the Irish Midlands, and obviously we know Kildare people are very connected to that.
Oh, that's true, yeah. Across a lot of the Midlands, there's quite a lot of bogs, but local bogs and Bord na Mona bogs, and there's a huge cultural identity driven from that, economically and through tradition of foot and turf and harvesting teas and the like of that. And particularly now with the move towards conservation, it's a very topical subject, and it's quite interesting. It's very interesting to photograph for me, actually. It's kind of like photographing the end of an era.
Yeah, it must be so odd. So tell us about some of the images that are on display.
Well, I've kind of photographed over the last 4 years, mostly in Kildare, and there's quite a lot of bog landscapes taken kind of all year round in the winter, summer. And then, say, in the summer, I kind of focused on people more so, and their foot and turf and stuff like that, and I photographed them. Now, the exhibition is mostly photographic. I also have some handmade paper that I made from peace in the exhibition too, so that brings a kind of a materiality aspect to it. It's almost like a flattened out sod of turf, for want of a better word.
Very cool. That must have been hard work to get that flattened out, that sod of turf.
Well, it wasn't actually a sod of flattened out sod of turf. It looked like one. It took some time it's a difficult process to get to the point to actually have some flattened out paper in the end. But it's probably going to be my next exhibition, I think.
Watch this space.
Yes, exactly, yes. It's kind of, there's a lot of reaction to it.
Very cool. Very cool. Yeah. But you're going to be doing a final artist tour of the work. That's on the 13th of December. So is that Monday or Sunday, the 13th?
Monday.
Monday, okay. Yeah. So that will be taking place at 7. But obviously this is open at the moment in the Riverbank in Newbridge, just across, if people know, from the Air Pell, just down from the Garda station. Obviously, I think everybody knows where that is. And admission is free. You don't need to book. You've noted about people who are concerned about, you know, COVID and the pandemic in general, that usually during the day it's quite quiet in the gallery, so people can kind of, I guess, have less stress about popping in and seeing some of the imagery.
Totally, yeah. It's quite relaxed in there. As you know, like, there's quite a lot of different things to go on there. The actual gallery space is kind of tucked away, and during the day, if you probably have the space to yourself. And it's open during the day, and I think it's also open in evenings and weekends when events are on. So people should just check beforehand just to make sure there's actually an event on.
Yeah, so
come down and be disappointed.
Yeah, so as I was noting, it is free to attend, but booking obviously is essential.
Yeah.
And you can book on the Riverbank website. And we will put up that link a little later on kfmradio.com so people can get access to it and book places. As I said, Shane will be there on Monday doing one final artist tour of the work. That's at 7 p.m. And it's open generally, the Riverbank, between Monday and Friday from 9:30 to 5. And as Shane was mentioning, it's also open during events in the evenings and and the weekends. And it's running for 2 weeks, for another 2 weeks, I should say. And it's going to close on the 22nd of December. Well, thank you very much, Shane Heinen, photographer, about that free exhibition that is taking place on the bog landscape in the Midlands over in the Riverbank Theatre in Newbridge.
Kildare Focus with Kira Noble.